My name is Gene, and I too am an alcoholic. And always when I... Look at wise man. Sounds like the Rose Bowl. Whenever I identify myself as an alcoholic, I base that identification on how I interpret the definition of the word alcoholic, as it's defined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, a book written by alcoholics for alcoholics. And in that book it says this: we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And that's all it says. Doesn't make any reference to how much you drank, what you drank, where you drank, or what happened as a result of your drinking. It doesn't say in order to be an alcoholic, you got to drink wine, live on Skid Row, spend weekends in drunk tanks, marry the same woman four or five times. Most of us do that when we're sober. I'd certainly be remiss if I failed to thank the committee for inviting me down here. It's always a treat to come down to this part of the country. For those of you who don't know where I live, I live in what is popularly known in California as the wine country. That ought to make you feel good. The Napa Valley, if you don't know where that is. Have you ever seen a TV program called Falcon Crest? That's where I live. And believe it or not, we do have AA in the wine country, too. Not too good, but we have it, you know. I don't really know, and I tell you this in all honesty, what I want to talk to you about tonight is I feel very mixed emotions here because, first off, I'm envious of all of you. You're so young. I remember when I was that young. And I like to hit you all. Then I'm so happy to see you here because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 24 years old. But I certainly wasn't any example of success in this program. I fought you tooth and nail for 6 years. It took me 6 years to reach my first year of sobriety. And for any other reason than the fact that I'm probably too dumb to realize what they were trying to teach me, I failed miserably at this program. No education has not been an aid to me in sobriety. I come from the Lower East Side of New York City. And I was born and raised in what would be called a ghetto area, I guess, nowadays. And education in my early life was a very difficult thing for me. I can't even explain it. You know, you all went to school, most of you, at least to the sixth or seventh grade, some of you. And in the school that I went to, you know, in every class, there's always three kinds of kids. There's the smart kids, and there's the average kids, and then in every class, there's a couple of dumbbells, you know. And I was the dumbbell in my class, you know. I was a guy that just couldn't catch on to anything. As a matter of fact, the New York State Board of Regents put me on what they call special education. Nowadays, they call it Welcome Back Cotter. And I stayed in the same room for 8 years, and whatever came first, dating the teacher or smoking, determined if he got out of that room or not. And the first traumatic experience I ever had, you know, happened right about that time, because when I left the grade school level and was going to go into high school, the first thing they confronted me with there was that I had to take a foreign language. Now, that scared the hell out of me because I've been getting F in English for 8 years. You know, the school I went to wasn't... That kind of school I went to was... I just noticed one today. Coming down to the airport this morning, I had to go through our more affluent county up there in Northern California, Marin County, you know. Peacock feathers and swimming pools and all that kind of jazz, you know. And it's very hoity-toity up there. And I'm a stonemason by trade. No longer. I got out of that business years ago, but that's the only trade I've ever known. So I've spent most of my life, you know, in the construction business, and I still have an active interest in it, you know. I go past a construction project, sometimes drive in, make sure they're doing it right, you know, and things like that. And I went past one between Novato and Petaluma today, and it's obviously going to be a new school. And when you hear this, you know, they got a big sign right out in front, you know, it says, future site of the Luella W. Pennington High School. Jesus. Right. Can you imagine telling somebody you go to Luella Pennington High School, you know? The logo on their football helmets must be a canary. The high school I went to didn't have a name, you know, it had a number, you know. It had a name and would have been something like Lucky Luciano Tech or Al Capone Prep, you know. driver's education in my high school was how to leave the scene of an accident. President of the senior class is a guy by the name of Vito. That ought to tell you the whole thing right there, you know. But on that day when they told me how to take a fire line, scared the living hell out of me. But my older brother Jack was along with me, and I'm an Irish Roman Catholic, so obviously as a small lad, I served on the altar of the church. So I know the Latin of the Mass, and I know the Confiteor and a few things like that. And so my brother says, you don't have much of a chance yet. It's a choice between French, German, Spanish, and whatever the hell the other one was, I don't know. So he says, your best bet would be to take Spanish. He says, it's a little bit like Latin. Might help you out a little bit. So as a freshman, I took Spanish 1. And as a sophomore, I took Spanish 1. And as a junior, I took Spanish 1. And I was still taking Spanish 1 in 1941 when I split from high school. And I enlisted in the United States Marines. And I lost my virginity in a house of ill repute in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And I learned more Spanish that night than I did in all 4 years of high school. Now, I don't tell you that, you know, to prove that I can be vulgar or obscene or anything like that. And as silly as this may sound, what I'm about to tell you is the absolute truth. Due to my inability to be involved in any kind of formal process called education, and due to my experience in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, I had instilled into me a blind faith in practical experience. And I am convinced to this day that when that time came in my life, as it came in yours, that I had to reach out for some kind of recovery. As the book says, you know, generally a dilemma precedes our decision whether to continue on in our madness or to reach out for recovery. When that time came in my life, and I reached out for Alcoholics Anonymous, if this program called AA had been anything other than the sharing of one alcoholic's experiences with another, I'm convinced that I'd be dead today, I'd be back in the penitentiary today, or I'd be living again as an animal on Chicago Skid Row. If this had been a program where I had to come in here on Monday morning, read chapter 5, and then Friday afternoon, answer 30 true or false questions on what the hell I read, forget it, Charlie, I couldn't do that. Or if I had to write a 500-word written composition on the third chapter more about alcoholism, forget it, Charlie, I couldn't do that either. I could hardly even understand some of the words in the book. And God, as I understand them, placed into my life 3 men. And I don't say what I'm about to say to harm anybody or criticize anybody here or in your groups. It's just how I feel. I was blessed with 3 men who never said this to me, something that I hear an awful lot today. I want you to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. They never said that. The guys that worked with me, Ozzy, Ray, and Bill, said, we are going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I believe it is almost lethal to send a newcomer to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous unescorted. How the hell is he or she going to know whether or not they're hearing right or wrong? Right off the bat, they're looking for the wrong. You know that. And so these 3 guys literally walked the words for me that I had to hear. I didn't hear them too good for 6 years. No. I had every excuse that you had, and I had every reason that you had, and I never had any desire. I never wanted to be an alcoholic. And I used to think that was unique until I read the book. And in the book, it says most of us were unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. That sort of took me out of the star stage right there, because I wasn't unique anymore, you know. And as a result of that, I had to go out and do what I had to do. I had to do my thing. One of the very first meetings I went to, you know, as I tell you before, I was in the construction business, and there was a guy by the name of McGinnis, and I use his name freely now because he's gone on to the bigger meetings up above, you know, but he was an iron worker foreman for American Bridge and Iron. And I used to run a crew of stonemasons and bricklayers, and whenever McGinnis and I would wind up on the same project, so some kind of personality clash or something, in a matter of days, we'd be at each other's throats. Bang, 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 you know, or something. Nobody ever could really figure out why, you know. Sometimes they even had a pool, you know, how long me and McGinnis would last before we'd get into it. And so the very first meeting I went to in a little town called Dixon, Illinois, I did what a lot of you did. I didn't pay any attention to what the hell they were talking about. I was looking around to see who was there. And the only person I saw that I knew was McGinnis. And I hadn't seen him around for quite a while. And I figured, this is where he is, you know. And so when the meeting broke up, I started out a door, and McGinnis was standing by the doorway, and I figured, uh-oh. When I go past him, he's going to blindside me bigger than hell, you know. And so I sort of moved slowly past him. And as I got up to him, he said, "Well, hot shot, what did you think of the meeting?" And I said something nasty like, "Well, it's a great place for assholes like you. Keep coming back," or something like that. And he said what he should have said. He says, "Well," he says, "I figured something like that from a jerk like you." He says, "So go on out and get yourself a story," he says, "and then if you can crawl back and the doors are open, come on back." That's the first time that I ever did what I was told to do in AA. I went out and I got myself the story. I went out there and I got to that point that brought me to you. Everything that I did is all right. I'm not sorry for any drink I ever took. I'm not sorry for any of the harm that I've ever caused or any of the hurt that I've caused, because obviously all of that was necessary to bring me here tonight. And right where I am this very moment is the best place in the world for an alcoholic like me. And so I have made the amends. I've tried to make the amends. I've been willing to make the amends. Some people accepted them. Some people didn't. But I am here, and that's the selfish part of this program. I am sober. I am sober. I could stand here for hours on end and tell you them tales of woe, but really that's not what we're here for tonight, you know. We're here to celebrate, you know what? I love the slogan you got. You know, I didn't know what the hell to talk about until I saw that slogan. We are the future. And I want to get into that a little bit, but I guess I'm obligated to tell you how I got here, what got me here, and what I do since I've been here, you know. I had to finally reach that point, and I mentioned the word dilemma before. Generally, it says the dilemma will precede our... I never knew what the hell dilemma meant, you know. I'm a student of the dictionary. I have educated myself, you know, since my sojourn here in AA. And every day I pick out two words, you know, out of the newspaper or whatever the hell I try to read. And then I look them up in the dictionaries. I have an enormous amount of dictionaries, you know, and I need them because many of the dictionaries have different definitions for a word. And then I try to use those two words only as often as I can, that day only in my conversation. And so for the past, you know, 30-odd years, you know, I've been able to sort of pick up and know a little bit about what I'm talking about. Because, you see, it was very embarrassing in the beginning. You know, I have always wanted to tell people, you know, people say to me, "Don't you drink anymore?" And I say, "No." And it'd be fine, you know, if they leave you alone right then and there. But then they say, "Well, why?" And, well, after a while, you're allowed to lie a little, right? You know, so I always lie. "Well, I just give it up for today, or my mother's coming tonight, or I'm going to dentist for some kind of crap." But really, down inside of my gut, I have always wanted to tell people why every morning I make a decision not to drink, put a needle in my arm, anything up my nose, eat it, and then pocket rockets or any of this other kind of crap, you know. Because inside of me, it used to scream out, you know, why I don't drink anymore. But I was always afraid to let it come out because I would sound stupid. Because I didn't know how to put this word in front of this word or this word here in this sentence. So I would just shut up. I would say, and that was it. But some years ago, I got blessed, you know. I was invited to be a participant in the anniversary of AA down in that Stanislaus County in Stockton. And I know there's some people here from Stockton, but I'm sorry. Let's face it, you know, Stockton is not the French Riviera, you know. It's about as exciting as a paint can, an empty paint can. Big deal in Stockton on a Saturday is going through the work clothes department at a J.C. Penney store. Ho, ho, ho! Red top socks, you know. And I was holed up in one of them motels there in the afternoon, hotter than hell in Stockton, boy, and I'm watching one of them Saturday afternoon classics, you know. Shirley Temple makes it with Godzilla. And then the commercial came on. You've all seen the commercial because it was an award-winning commercial. And it had such an impact on my life that I actually researched that commercial. And it was filmed right in San Francisco Bay. And it was filmed on one of our beautiful days in October. And those of you who know our part of the state, October is our real summer, you know. That's the nicest month to be in San Francisco. And the bay was just a sheet of glass, you know, and all the little sailing boats were out there. Looked like little white butterflies flitting around. And whew, they zoomed in onto one of these sailing boats with a camera. And there was a bunch of young people running up and down the decks, you know, 18, 19 years old. They had cut off blue jeans on, little funny little hats and weird T-shirts. And they were shimmying up the post, diving into the bay, swinging on the lines, dropping off, just jackassing around, having a hell of a time. And then the punchline came on. And you've seen it. It said, you only go around once. Grab all of the gusto you can. And I didn't know what the hell gusto was. And I went out to the desk, and they had a little apartment back there where they lived, the manager, wherever he was. And I borrowed a dictionary off them, and I looked up the word gusto. And it said, gusto, slang expression for living. You only go around once. Grab all of the living you can. And that's why at approximately 20 minutes after 5 this morning, with the help of a God as I understand him, I asked for the help of him and this program to get me through today without taking a drink, putting a needle in my arm, smoking in them funny little cigarettes, and any other kind of mood-altering, personality-changing crap that I used to think was living. Because I want all of the living I can get. I want every bit of life that there is. Life, as you and I or anybody who walks the face of this earth knows, is the most precious thing that you or I will ever experience. And there's some very cold, cold facts about life that are worth reviewing on occasions. It don't make any difference who you are or what you are or what you think you are. Doesn't make any difference the color of your skin, church of your choice, the country of your national origin, whether you're rich, poor, dumb, or smart. One to a customer, that's it. One time through, that's the name of the game. One shot. And the coldest fact of all about life. Here's one that'll ruin a good night's sleep. The moment that life starts, it begins to get shorter. Every unit of time that goes by is a portion of your life that is over, done, finished. In a much colder vein, every unit of time that goes by is bringing you that much closer to the end of your life. Example, never again will anybody in this room or any other room like this in any other place today ever experience 8 p.m. March 19th, 1993. That's a part of your life that is over. Done. Never to be had again. And life isn't a VCR, you know. You can't put it on rewind or pause or hold. Life goes on at its pace. And the older you get, the faster that pace seems to be, you know. Rushing towards its inevitable end. Because that's another thing we share in common. Or we should realize we share in common. Life as you and I know it will come to an end. There will be an end to this thing called life. I don't know about you, but I don't think I'm that unique. I want, as I said before, every bit of it. I want to go every place there is to go. I want to see everything there is to see. I want to read every book that was ever written, hear every song that was ever sung. I want to say hello to the whole world. I want it all. And there's really nothing wrong with wanting it all, as long as you have enough sense to realize you're not going to get it all. And that's what makes you and I a lot luckier than a lot of those people out there. Because you and I know, or should know, by our own experiences and the sharing of these experiences, that we can get more of this life clean and sober than we ever got using and abusing. We have already proved that to ourselves. Kid asked me here just before the meet, I don't know how long you're sober or what. He's in here looking for the guarantee, he said. How could I be sure? He wanted to know that this is where he belonged. I don't know if this is where you belong, son. But if you think you've got a problem with the drug of your choice, you belong here if you want to do something about it. And as far as a guarantee, Again, the closest thing that I know of a guarantee, with the exception of the reading in the fifth chapter of the book. I and other people like me, Mary here and Keith and a few others around here, have been very fortunate in our AA careers. We've been allowed to be participants in AA activities all over these United States, foreign countries. There's supposed to be almost 2 million members of AA now. Without trying to impress you, I think I know about at least 150,000 of them. Maybe I don't know their names, middle initials, but I'm hi, how are you, and stuff like that. And I've been here, you know, since 1950. And with your understanding, I want to tell you something. I think I have heard everything you could possibly hear in AA. I realize I'm in a continuing state of learning, and that every day I can learn something new. But right as of this moment, I believe I've heard everything there is to hear. I don't think that we could sit down and discuss the steps or the traditions or the concepts or anything else right now, where if I didn't try hard enough, I couldn't attach a similar conversation someplace in my past. I don't really think anybody in this room or any other room could get up and tell their own story right now, where again, if I tried hard enough, I couldn't recall a similar story. Maybe it's back in Massachusetts or up in Portland, Oregon, or Auckland, New Zealand, or Honolulu. In other words, what I'm trying to tell you, and I repeat, with your understanding, I believe I've heard it all. Except one thing. There's one thing I have never heard. Now, what I'm about to tell you, I'm going to repeat twice, because I don't want to get misquoted on this. And I often do. The thing that I have never heard on this program has been far more important to me than everything I have heard. The thing that I have never heard on this program has been far more important to me than everything I have heard. For you see, I have never heard a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, male or female, say that his or her life got worse when they stopped drinking. I have never heard anybody say they were sorry that they no longer drink. I don't hear people running around these rooms saying, shit, it's a long time since I've been in the emergency room. God, I miss them tubes going down my stomach. Remember them tubes, huh? They put them down there and start sucking. They think you're bringing your shoes right up through your gut, you know. Never heard anybody miss these things. And so things like that keep me coming back here. But I have to be on guard, just like you have to. I know that at any given moment it could be tonight. That my thinking can change just like that. I would swear on my mother's name right now that I'll never take another drink as long as I live. But I know that promise can only last until the first insane thought enters my mind. And you know what's the scary thing about insane thoughts entering your mind? You're a bunch of young people, you like to play games. I'll give you a game right now. Trivia. Popular word if you return to drinking in AA is called a slip, right? What's the prime requirement for a slip? There's one thing that has to be before you can have a slip. What is it?
Picking up the first drink.
You have to be sober. Now, what does that mean? For people like you and I, to return to drinking is an insane act. Insanity is defined in the dictionary as any time you place your life or the life of others in jeopardy by your actions. So for people like you and I, to return to drinking is an insane act. What I have just said to you about the slip means this. People like you and I are capable of making an insane decision when we are sane. And that's why we come to these meetings. That's why we live this program. That's why we work these steps or live these steps. To keep ourselves from making insane decisions when we're sane. I don't know, and I don't want to put a wet blanket on anybody in here, but what the hell, you know, truth is truth, and how it is how it is. Some of us in this room are going to drink again. You know that, and I know that. We can't be that naive to believe that everybody in this room is finished drinking. It just isn't like that. They wrote that in the book 53 years ago, so don't look at me askance as though I'm putting a death wish on you. It says it right there in the book if you get around to reading it. It says, despite all that we can say, many who are real alcoholics, by every form of self-deception and experimentation, they'll try to prove themselves the exception to the rule. And they'll drink again. They'll drink again. And I don't want to be one of them people. And what do they want to drink again for? I don't want to be a normal drinker. There was an alcoholic who walks the face of this earth that could stand being a social drinker for 2 minutes. Have you ever watched a normal drinker? They're enough to drive you to drink, really. They leave a half a glass on the bar and go home. They say the goddamnedest things. No thanks. 2's it for me. I'm driving. Let's see. But yet, as silly as it sounds, we all know people who paid a hell of a price to try to become that, to try to become that, to try to become a normal drinker, a normal drinker. Well, the time finally came for me at the end of my route, you know, that I had to make that decision. And that dilemma that they talk about that precedes the decision, and I didn't understand that. Like, I asked the guy once, I said, what the hell does dilemma mean? And he says, well, and he was a school teacher, and he knew my case. He says, I don't want to get any big words up. He says, but to you, he says, a dilemma is when you have the opposite answers for the same question, and both answers are valid. I figured this guy's going into early male menopause or something. How the hell can you have the opposite answers for the same question and both of them be right? And he said, you just think about it for a while. Well, I don't know how long I thought about it, whether it was a day, a month, a week, or a year. But one day, you know, I realized exactly what he said. When my moment came, you know, and that moment comes in all of our lives in different places on different stages with different players. I was living on Chicago Skid Row, West Madison Street. As an animal, there's no other way to describe it. I had been down there for about 17 months. And my drinking now had regressed to, you know, as low as you can get. There was not even any need. You know, my lifespan was a 20-minute period. The only thought I had on my mind was drink, you know. I could care less about anything else, family, friends, anything. I just figured that if I don't get a drink every 20 minutes, I'm going to die. Just as soon as I would get a drink, you know. Before I'd even savor the drink, you know, I'd wonder, am I going to get another one in 20 minutes or am I going to die, you know. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, that's when it starts, right? And a lot of you know exactly what the hell I'm talking about. You shuffle into them goddamn places, you know, and maybe it's wintertime and you've got one of them army surplus coats from the Catholic Charities. It hangs down around your ankles, you know, and up over your head. And you just shuffle into a scumbag of a place like Big Rothschild's. And you get up to that bar and wait for that bartender to come down, and then that pimply-faced, redneck, bigoted asshole looks at you, you know, and he holds that wine bottle like that, and he doesn't tip it until he sees you. Then you go into them big pockets, you know, and you start bringing it out. Electrical conduit, bus tokens, Japanese money, pennies, nickels. And all the time you're hoping inside and your gut is screaming that Jesus Christ makes something add up to 15 cents. Because 15 cents means 4 ounces of wine. And 4 ounces of wine means whether you're going to die or not. And maybe through the grace of God, finally, you know, he reaches in there and he sorts it out and he's got enough. And he pours that drink, right? And you have been there. Maybe he wasn't at Rothschild's,
Might have been at your own kitchen table. You might have been behind a billboard someplace or in a hotel room, but you've been there. You know exactly what I'm going to say. You know, people don't know me and you, do they? They say, oh, the alcoholic. They go, he's the last one to know it. You and I knew long before everybody else that there was something wrong. You knew that, and I knew that. And that's what happens at that moment, you know, when that dilemma is about to come upon you. You can always tell the alcoholic on Skid Row, aside from the common drunk. You know that? You know how you can tell the alcoholic? He cries. That's right. Alcoholics cry before they've had their first drink. And they cry for that one thing that most of us are ashamed of, and I think it's the greatest thing that can happen. Guilt. People say, oh, I feel so guilty. Oh, I'm guilty. Hey, that's great. Boy, I wish they'd just pile it on you. Take it all. Guilt is the greatest thing that can happen to the alcoholic. Because guilt is a signal. Guilt is a signal that there is still some decency left inside of your gut. If there was no decency left in your gut, you would not feel guilt. And decency is what's required to initiate a desire and a willingness to do something about it. In other words, you're standing up and you're saying, I don't want to be like this. And that's because of guilt. But before that, you looked at that goddamn drink. And you know it's killing you. You knew that and I knew that. Jesus Christ, if I drink this son of a bitch, it's going to kill me. But then that other guy is talking in the back. And he's saying, yeah, but if you don't drink it, you'll die. Opposite answers for the same question. And they're both right. If I drink it, it kills me. And if I don't drink it, I'll die. And it's at that moment they say, I have to make a decision. For God's sake, how the hell can me and you and people like you and I make any kind of a decision at a moment like that? So who makes the decision? Do you think you made the decision? Do you think it was your idea? No. Somewhere, that power comes. And that's what we're talking about, is power. We're not talking about a religious idol or a sacred picture. When we talk about God, it says right in that book, the word God is only used to identify a power. A power greater than ourselves. We are talking about power. The first step tells us what's wrong with us. We are powerless. So we need a power. And so obviously you and I and people like you and I in this room reached out for that power. And through whatever means, it worked. And it brought to you and I this great thing called sobriety. To maintain the sobriety wasn't easy at first. I had to learn the simplicity of this program. And I learned that in a little town called Crystal Lake, Illinois. I learned it as a result of two ladies at the meeting. I had gone to an AA meeting that I didn't want to go to, that I hated to go to, but I was under a commitment to a sponsor to go to, so I went. Only thing attractive about that meeting, Crystal Lake was sort of a bedroom community of Chicago, very affluent people, and there was one old lady. The society matron, kind of a lady you see in the Great Gatsby or something, wore a big flowy hat here, you know. And in the summertime, she wore gloves up over her elbows, you know. And her name was Helene. And every time I'd jump out of the back of this little pickup truck that we rode up in, she'd see me first and she'd say, oh, Jean, it's such a delight to see you. Gee, I didn't want to tell anybody I liked that, but I did. You know, nobody ever talked to me like that, you know. So I was sort of attracted to this old lady, you know, and she was always the first one there. She used to put out them little pieces of paper with all the holes in them, you know, and by each chair. And then with a little Dixie cup on top of it, you know, and put some nuts in there and some candies. And if you got to sit in one of them chairs, you got one of them little things with the nuts in them, you know. But I never got. I come in late all the time. I had to sit. I go to kindergarten, get one of them little kindergarten chairs and sit on, you know. But that was all right. I don't want to hear anything anyhow. And I'm not picking on the women. This is exactly how it happened. And thank God it was. Meeting was about midway gone, and all of a sudden comes tumbling down the stairs is a woman, drunker than five sailors at Pearl Harbor. Man, I mean, well, she carrying a package, you know. And, man, they couldn't shut her up. Every time somebody started to talk, this Selma would jump up and interfere. And the chairman would go, Selma, sit down. We'll talk to you after the meeting. And Selma would sit down, you know, and somebody started talking it up and jump Selma. And Selma, sit down. We're gonna just kept up for about half an hour. And I'm getting embarrassing. Everybody's embarrassed. She jumped up. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this sweet little Helene stood up and said, Selma, sit down and shut the fuck up. That was like hearing Whistler's mother say something. Couldn't believe it. You know, if you had the whole world in front of you and somebody said, pick out the one person in the world who'd never say that word, everybody would pick out Elaine, you know. I couldn't believe it. And then this Selma turned on her the way only people like you and I can do when we're in our cups. With that filthy, vile. And she called her every words I wouldn't even repeat in here, you know. Horrible things, you know. Embarrassing. We all had our heads down low. And the last thing she said to Helene, she said, Helene, what makes you so goddamn great? You came in here with me 9 years ago, and you never took another drink. She said, what the hell did you do that I didn't do? And, man, my head went up with that. What the hell did she do? I never saw her do nothing except put out them nuts and them candy things. And every time the secretary say, Helene, anything you'd like to say tonight? You've got to be in your group. She says, no, thanks, but I'm so grateful to be here. I think I'll pass. That's all the hell I ever heard her say. So I wanted to hear, what the hell did you do? And I can see sweet Helene now, just she's looking around at the group as I'm looking at you, saying, well, hell, you know what I did. And she just looked at Selma, and she said, why, Selma, I just did what I was told. And it didn't hit me right then and there. But on the way home that night, summer night, I'm sitting in the back of this pickup truck, and I'm thinking about that. I just did what I was told. And then the clarity came, you know. And the simplicity of this program just sort of opened up to me, you know. Everything that I'd heard so many times began to make sense. If you want what I have. Rarely have we seen a person fail who was thoroughly followed up there. Abandon yourself to God. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him. God could and would if he was. Why am I having so much trouble? Why don't I just do those things? And I didn't know why I didn't, but the stigma of the word alcoholic was still there. And this was in June. And about 10 or 12 days later, my sponsor said, International, this is 1965. International Convention is up in Toronto, Canada. He said, I want you to go up there. You and two other guys, you hitchhike up there. And I didn't want to go. But I went. And how many times have you heard it? Keep going these meetings and you'll hear what you have to hear. And I heard it from the horse's mouth, Bill. I couldn't sit further away from the podium than I could. I was in way up at the top in the hockey rink up there, Maple Leaf Garden. Because I didn't want to even be seen with you. And there was Bill talking on Saturday night. And it's chronicled in our books now. That was the night he said, Alcoholics Anonymous is a program designed for people who seek a new way of life. Yeah, Bill, I thought he was talking to me. That's what I want. New way of life. I want to start all over again. You know, he didn't call me an alcoholic. He didn't call me an outcast. He didn't say, you're washed up, you're a loser. He said, we're here just for people who are looking for a new way of life. And I wanted it. And that was the night I wanted it. And then I took it. Here I am now. But that's enough about me. With your permission, I want to talk about you. Because as I was chatting away here, something just came to my mind. I see the T-shirt go by there, you know. You are the future. Well, that's true. That's true. You are the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you know what your future is? Have you given any thought to what this is? May I please share some thoughts with you? Right or wrong, I don't know, but they're my thoughts. Our co-founder, Bill, and it's chronicled in our history. Early in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill was a great promoter. And during World War II, Bill got on his horse, even tried to enlist, as you know, but they wouldn't take him. And he was so excited about AA and its growth. And he thought, Jesus Christ, why don't we give this to the whole world? Why don't we get the whole world to live these steps? Well, at that time, wiser heads, put Bill down. They just shut up, sit down, you know. And from that came singleness of purpose, which was great. Undoubtedly, that's what we needed. Bill and his program wasn't ready for the world. But Bill would never stop talking about that. And he carried it right to his deathbed, and I know this from Nell Wing. He'd talk to anybody who'd listen about that dream. Well, time has gone on, hasn't it? What if the world lived these steps? Could it be? Are we more than just AA? Was sobriety just the foundation of why we were chosen? Is there something more than this that will be entrusted to you? To you, the young people? It says in some of our literature that you have been entrusted with a power. There's that word power again. The power to heal. Well, let's take a look at something that's been going on about the last 10 years. I might be a little off on dates and figures here, but you'll know what I'm talking about. Some time ago, I think it was 44 people, most of them from Southern California here, and a few from Texas, took it upon themselves without any sanction from the World Service Office and went over to Russia and introduced our program to the Russians. And this was not lately. This was when we were told to hate the Russians. This was when we feared the Russians. This is when the world was a two-power world. And yet these people went over there. And the first guy they met was a guy by the name of Victor, who lives up in Mill Valley, California now. Victor started the first meeting, the beginners group, in Moscow. And at that meeting were two other guys, one from Lithuania and one from what was Czechoslovakia. And they carried their message to Lithuania and to Czechoslovakia. And somehow somebody in Czechoslovakia wound up in East Berlin. And in the last 10 years, the Berlin Wall has come down. Czechoslovakia no longer has communism. Either there's Lithuania, I don't have to tell you about Russia. The only place in the European continent where Irish Roman Catholics can sit with Protestant Irishmen as at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. There must be something there. We call it a fellowship. So I just sort of let these things phase through me, running. Well, how much? Too bad Bill don't know about this, you know. And then I went to the convention in Montreal. And everybody knows what the Friday night ceremony is at our international conventions, the flag ceremony, the most emotional moment that you'll ever spend in AA. And it was fantastic. There was 81 countries represented in the flag ceremony, and that was a tremendous deal. And then 5 years later, we gathered in Seattle, Washington, in the Kingdom, and some of you were there. And everybody knew what was about to happen. We knew there were going to be three other flags in that ceremony that night, but nobody had really said anything. And And as each country was called forth, if you were never there, I should explain what happens. The country comes forward with a member of that country, a member of AA, with his country's flag. He places it in a stanchion and in his native tongue says, "My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic." It might be in Swahili, it might be in Dutch, Spanish, Italian. And they went right through the 81 countries, and the United States is always the last one because we're the host country. But there were three flags still down there in that audience, and everybody knew they were there. And then what I consider was the most emotional experience in my entire life took place when Victor walked up before the microphone and in Russian said, "My name is Victor, and I'm an alcoholic." And he was followed by the man from Lithuania and the man from Czechoslovakia. And never in my life have I ever seen such an outburst of love and affection. Those of you who were there know exactly what I'm talking about. The tremendous flow of love that went through that crowd of 52,000 people. Hugging each other, loving each other. Hugging Russians. Black men hugging white men. Hispanics hugging Orientals. Orientals hugging red men. It made no difference. Maybe Bill was right. Maybe Bill was right. What if? Sounds so crazy. But just what if? What if the world today lived these steps? Like us, there'd be no Somalia. They wouldn't be killing each other over in Czechoslovakia now. You wouldn't be sitting on a powder keg here in Los Angeles worrying about the outcome of a trial. There wouldn't be homeless people scattered throughout the world. There wouldn't be little babies starving to death. If the whole world lived as we live in this very room, it would be a wonderful place, a wonderful place. And I think that's what's been entrusted to you. Oh, I'll get criticized for saying this, I know that. And I've outlived my critics, you know. But that's what I believe you are. That's what I believe you are, the future. We were the beginning. The Marys, the Chucks, and all of the other people that you revere so honestly here in Southern California. We were the beginning. We were the beginning. And now, you know, to be very literary, we pass the torch, you know. And that's what we have done for you. You say, we are the future of AA. You are the future, period. Thank you.